newspaper or periodical called The Interior. She clipped it. Thanks to The Interior for the following faithful picture. Yes, you get credit. But my point is that this is a different type of writing. It's a department that she has. And after she quotes this article, The Perils of Travel, she finishes that with a little line of her own. These are very good and wholesome words. Now, please look on page 231. Well, no, page 230. You see there's an article, Death Indoors. All right. Well, all of that, Death Indoors, over to the next column, is clipped from Paul's Journal of Health. You see that? And then she has a line. As I read the above, I involuntarily exclaimed, good. And so she put it in here. This is a different type of material than you find in her article in the review. I don't find here the woe is me if I don't preach this to the people. It's sort of an obligation. Her husband has said, we need 4 to 6 pages from you. May we have them, please? So she's looking for anything she can set her hands on that would fill these 4 or 6 pages. Now, would you please come to... We won't have time to look at much. You can look at most of this in your spare time. Come over to... page 121. October 1871. You'll have to go about 10 or 12 pages. Oh, I see. It's my page 11.
11 in the circle.
11 in the circle in the bottom, right. And there you have page 121 in the Health Reformer of October 1871. Here is where Mrs. White makes this statement about the Whigs. It's in this type of setting, you see. The bottom of the left-hand column on 121. Fashion loads the heads of women with artificial braids and pads, which do not add to their beauty, but give an unnatural shape to the head. The hair is strained and forced into unnatural positions, and it is not possible for the heads of these fashionable ladies to be comfortable. The artificial hair and pads covering the base of the brain heat and excite the spinal nerves centering in the brain. The head should ever be kept cool. The heat caused by these artificials induces the blood to the brain. The action of the blood upon the lower or animal organs of the brain causes unnatural activity, tends to recklessness in morals, and the mind and heart is in danger of being corrupted. As the animal organs are excited and strengthened, the moral are enfeebled. The moral and intellectual powers of the mind become servants to the animal. Skip a paragraph. Many have lost their reason and become hopelessly insane by following this deforming passion. The passion. Now, you'll notice there's a long paragraph which follows that, and that ends, the martial statesman says. So Ellen White, it seems to me, is getting some of her information from these periodicals and is not pretending that this is necessarily all counsel from God. A physician writing a series of letters to a schoolgirl devotes one to the nice keeping of the hair and then tells her why she should not wear this chignon or swish. Now, let us go to the next page. Well, page 123. It's the back of this sheet. My page 12. Over on page 123, the bottom of the left-hand column. After completing the foregoing, and this is all about your hair and what you should and shouldn't wear, after completing the foregoing, I found the following. And that's in the right-hand column, evils of hair dyes and cosmetics. After completing the foregoing, I found the following. You can see what she's doing. I have had some experience in using Mrs. S.A. Allen's World's Hair Restorative, also Hall's Vegetable Sicilian Hair Restorative. I have made applications of these preparations upon the head of my husband.
You're
to prevent the falling off of the hair. I observed that when using these preparations, he frequently complained of giddiness of the head and weakness and pain of the eyes. Now, this has some humor in. But doesn't this seem to be a little different type of writing in a different setting than the articles and the signs and the review? You go and get those articles, it's a completely different situation. Here she's trying to help her husband so that the magazine will not go under. All right, let's read another one now. Let's go to my page 17. Oh, thank you. The circle page 17, and that is page 156 of the Health Reformer of November 1871, is what that is. Right-hand column. The first indented paragraph. By lacing, this is women lacing their dresses. By lacing, the internal organs of women are crowded out of their positions. There's scarcely a woman that is thoroughly healthy. The majority of women have numerous ailments. Many are troubled with weaknesses of most distressing nature. These fashionably dressed women cannot transmit good constitution to their children. Some women have naturally small waists, but rather than regard such forms as beautiful, they should be viewed as defective. Now, here is her comment, the next line. Said, I have a question about, you know, did God tell her this? These wasp waists may have been transmitted to them from their mothers as the result of their indulgence in the sinful practice of tight lacing and in consequence of imperfect breathing. And I haven't quite been able to see how this acquired characteristic by the mother could be passed on to the gene, to the child. But now when we turn on the next page, we'll see where Ellen White read something like this and even publishes it in this very issue of the Health Reformer, the very next page, the left-hand column, the first indentation. The following excellent remarks are from The Household, another paper she's quoting from. We'll skip the first paragraph. But my waist is naturally slender, says one woman. She means that she has inherited small lungs. These are not Mrs. White's words. These are words Mrs. White is quoting from this magazine. She means she has inherited small lungs. Her ancestors, more or less of them, compressed their lungs in the same way that we do, and it has become, in her case, a congenital deformity. This leads us to one of the worst aspects in the whole matter, the transmitted results of indulgence in this deadly vice. So when Mrs. White is reading things like this, publishing things like this, in her column, in her department, you can understand why she might write a few things like this herself. So, brethren and sisters, what I have done just now is something that I have hesitated to do. I've never done it anywhere else. But I've hesitated to do it for fear somebody will get the wrong impression, you know. Because here I am stating, in effect, that I question whether some of the writing of Ellen White is inspired in the sense that others of her writings are. In fact, questioning the inspiration, you see, of some of these things. And it would have to be drawn between the common and the sacred. So I'm sort of burying my heart here, telling you how I am looking at some of these things. Now, before we call on anybody for questions, and you'll have to field the questions, you'll have to call on the people. I want the liberty of calling on Elder White to see if he has a comment to make first. Elder White, I don't know how you look at these matters. If you look at them entirely as I do, I know we have talked about them. Do you have anything to add?
Well, I think it's very clear that during these 4 years, Ellen White was wearing two hats, that of a prophet and that of an editor. When James Wright persuaded her to furnish three or four printed pages, which would be the equivalent between 2,000 and 3,000 words, for each issue of the Health Reformer published monthly. Financially, she could bring into it those things which were shown to her in vision, which she set forth in her writings on health. But from the standpoint of volume, they were rather limited. And so here we find her in a different, a unique position that she was never put in before. That of having to sit down and grind out 2,000 or 3,000 words a month, whether sick or well, at home or traveling, no matter what, she had to grind them out. And we are faced, of course, with this problem of her counsel regarding degrees of inspiration. Now, friends, I've got to deal with this demography about a year. I'm feeling around for how we should deal with it. The Bob says we bared our souls here to you, to our trusted counselors. And I see no other way than to take the position that when she took over the department in the Health Reformer, she, in a sense, did it outside of her work in the prophetic office. Now, I wish we could have time while you're all here to spend an hour in a council we gained from you to help with the kit. You'll recall that those who have read the minutes, misnamed the minutes of the 1990 Bible Conference, actually the minutes of an informal meeting of Bible teachers held a week or two later, have observed that the brethren there were concerned. They raised questions. Those questions had been answered freely and frankly. There was no agenda. They came unprepared. Some of the speeches are as wild as can be, and as far from the back. Others are nearer the back. But the brethren felt that we had a responsibility to inform our people. Somehow, how can we inform them and teach them so that they can come at these questions in a rational way? Questions over copying from other writers, locations in great conferences, and so on. And they all decided that something must be done. These were teachers who were going back to their classrooms. They asked Daniel to come back a second day. They talked about, what can we do? What should we say in our classrooms? Now, at that time, there were perhaps a larger percentage of Seventh-day Adventists than today, but there are too many of them who hold the verbal inspiration. And it was a real problem that the brethren faced. They hadn't thought of dealing with these questions with our people. They decided that something must be done. But what did they do? Took the minutes and locked them up in the General Conference vault. I myself, who worked for the White State for 50 years, did not know those minutes were dug up a few years ago. It was a conference. Now, my father was not there. I'm sure if he had been there, or Doris Robinson was not there, one of the secretaries from the office. He was at the Bible Conference because he was an editor. My father was invited because he was a member of the General Conference Committee, and incidentally, they invited all the members of the General Conference Committee. When my father started to write to the brethren back here in Washington about it, they hedged him hard about it because I don't think they really intended that members of the General Conference Committee should come in from a distance. My father decided not to come. I wish he had come, because he could have put a good many matters straight that were distorted. And let me tell you, there is great distortion in those minutes. I sometimes want to sit down and prepare, so I'm going to bother you, and I can't do anything I want to do. Now, here we are. It's only, I would say, Bob, it's only during the last, 36 months or so, that either you or me have been aware of some of the facts that are about today. We're awfully busy in the United States. We're awfully short-handed, and we're not spending time looking for problems. But we began to look at this and we came to all the historical facts and found that Ellen White was asked to conduct a department that put itself under special pressure. Now the Spirit of the Lord called to her mind those things that have been revealed in regard to health reform vision. But she had no way of demanding of the Spirit of God to furnish her with 1,500 words a month for the health reform. So what did she do? She just reached out, threw in whatever she could. And I think that we're going to have to recognize that we perhaps should be cautious about putting these articles, this department, prepared under these circumstances, in the same category as we would the other E.G. White writing. Now, maybe I'm all wrong, and maybe you can help us on this, but I see no other way. Now, it's true, from a mind which has been enlightened as was hers, in regard to the principle of health, that that was bound to come through. And it did. In many places. And we've even pulled it from some of this. We've even taken quotations from some of it for some of the devotional books. Now, immediately the question is going to be asked, how are we going to determine? What are we going to determine? I think we're going to have to think in terms of establishing certain criteria. Now, if Ellen White is writing about me in the health reformer, we don't need to question whether she had light from God on that or not. Because it's a question of which she's written on again and again and again. And deep breathing, and exercise, and all these things. These principles which she tells on again and again and again, why, they're in harmony with what was revealed to her, and we have ample sources otherwise. But you won't find anywhere in her writing, any place else, suggestion of an inherited physical deformity. And of course, people immediately thought about the finding of the women of the feet of the Chinese women. They give birth to children that have normal feet. And no matter how many generations, it doesn't change. And this is true. Nor will you find anywhere else right writing about weeks. You won't find it the sense woman, you won't find it in person. We may have to try to find some criteria. I hope we can. This is the reason I'm taking the time to deal with. We've got to think this through. But let's not go from this meeting, as did the brethren from the Bible teachers meeting in 1919, and just sit on our hands. We've got questions that we have to answer now. I think we're not finding any real problem in finding answers. It's going to shake our people a little bit. But it may help them in the study of inspiration, and I've been crying for that before the General Conference Committee for decades. The little is done. But, this is how I look at it, Bob. It's a serious situation. We've got to come to grips with it. I can hope that while the brethren are here, these wise brothers, counselors, spirit of honesty men, can help to give us counsel that's exciting how we can introduce this. I do hope and pray, brother, that you won't go away and some of you take this and distort it. You know, all through my life, I've had to be careful about every word I've said as it relates to the spirit of prophecy. Because I've found so many people are ready to take something and distort it, put it in a different light, and make me say something that I didn't say. And we have to be very, very careful about this. And I'm hoping that we can get further study to this while we're here. I think it's really a matter of importance. We have now disclosed it. We have now stated our feelings. We're on. There's some attempts. You know me well enough, Bob, to know that I'm ready to move in any direction that makes sense and is in harmony with that. So that's the way I feel about it. I think we've got to take a look at it, where it's a real problem that's coming up, and I don't think it's a problem. But I will, Bob, tomorrow on my feet, let me say one thing, Bob. And that is in the page 7 of your paper, under item number 4. Statement is made here in Spiritual Gifts 301, Ellen White placed the power of Babel before the flood. This might imply that Ellen White did not know when the Tower of Babel was built.
Yeah. Well,
it's an typographical error. It's not an error of Ellen White. It's a typographical error which is acknowledged corrected in the next verse. And the statement is that these people who did this then did something else. I don't have the exact wording you want, but I think that we should point out, while there are discrepancies, that in this case it's a typographical error, the addition of the word and a comma, which was corrected in the next verse.
Out of the way, thank you. I probably should not have even used that as an example because of that. Now, I want to, while I'm on my feet, I want to add one more point. Jonathan Butler said something this morning that I think is very important. I've felt this way for years. And that is that Mrs. White's counsel is reliable, if I heard you correctly. Her counsel is reliable, though the reasons for that counsel might be disputed. But still, the counsel is reliable. Isn't that a point you were making this morning? Because if you look at her advice, you know, it's advisable not to practice masturbation. The advice is absolutely sound, whether the reasons that are given are indisputable or not. And I really don't know of one place, I don't know of one example that anybody can give where Mrs. White has ever led our church wrong when they followed her counsel, or where we would be led wrong by following her counsel.
Okay. Gordon, first.
I suppose the fundamental question is, can we have it both ways? When she's copying for Desire of Ages, she chooses the right sources. And when she's copying here, she doesn't have that discriminating power. I'd like to answer my own question, and I think the answer is yes. And I think the most telling points are the fact of the department, that she was writing for her department, and most importantly, that this is not a recurring theme of emphasis that she carries throughout her ministry. I mean, the percentage of error with three or four insignificant statements, this is not really worth starting with.
I appreciate those comments. Thank you.
I have the material in this publication, Good Years, found its way into the compilation.
Yes, like Elder White mentioned, the book of My Life Today, I think it is, well, it's indicated here.
In the margins, you can see.
Yes.
Portions that are printed.
Mm-hmm.
The rubber stamp indicates it. I think I saw one in Council's
on
Diet and Food.
There's one Council's right in the center. See, on page 260, there's a passage from My Life. Page 5. My page 5. You see right here? In the middle of the margin, to turn that, it's My Life Today. So that's in the book from that particular spot. And
page 12 has Diet and Food.
And page 9 over here, My Life Today here, My Life Today here. And there are a number of selections that have been made.
Then this posture that we're suggesting today is something of a departure from the past, in terms of our own practice of using the writing.
Well, these
which has appeared in those books.
Well, let's hear you.
Our position with those is that that material is not of a 2-3 level nature.
On that point, Dr. Knittel, Frank and I are related, so I can call you Frank
right.
Tonight. Let me see. Your wife's niece is married to my sister's something like that. He takes the book, This Day with God. We have their letters, many letters to Edson White, her son. And as I have read some of these, I have felt, well, now this was, I don't believe, given under inspiration, but there's something here that can be very helpful in a spiritual sense. So I don't see that we're making the claim that everything we printed in the book This Day with God would have been written under inspiration. Yeah. Yeah.
But that point that is from Counsel's Diet of Food is something that's repeated and repeated and repeated. And
right.
That's another criteria you could use. And also, you can use the idea that, like with Paul, touching my cloak, I don't think Paul had to have a vision to know he was cold. But I think it did suit the Holy Spirit's purpose that be included in Scripture. And we have in selected messages, we have, I'm not a grammarian. I didn't need a vision to know that either. But I think it helps us understand inspiration better to have it there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can look at the books and notes in that light, they help us understand inspiration, even if we can't always draw a sharp line.
Mm-hmm. Ron, may I ask you a question? I asked this morning and nobody answered it. When Paul wrote, please send the books, the manuscripts, especially the parchments and so on, bring that quote, do you think he wrote that under inspiration?
I do.
This is my position. I do.
I think the Holy Spirit led him. I think the Holy Spirit saw to it that that was included in Scripture, okay?
Okay.
In that sense.
Yeah, that's fine.
But I don't think it was revealed to him that he wanted these parchments.
No.
Or do you think he had a short memory that
they
had to be reminded?
No. Okay, Roger Coon. Whatever final form our hermeneutics may take with regard to how we divide the line, I think we need to be very careful by saying, well, if it was in the department, then we can kind of take care of it on that basis, because the waste that appears on page 17 of your compilation also appears in the Review and Herald. And if we look, we may find, to our distress, some of these other things also appearing in the Review and Herald. So whatever form, final form our hermeneutic takes, I think we've got to be awfully careful, because some of these things that appeared in the Health Reformer that are hard to be understood also appeared in the Review and Herald.
That's right. This same article. This is why I didn't rewrite it in a different form. But this same article was published in the Review. That's right.
Yeah, due to this, I think you'll find that the whole series of articles are now in my stand in the Health Reformer. He published in the Review and Herald in 1899.
Including the Whig statement?
Yes. First article. Including the Whig and Wasp Whig. She was in Australia. The brethren decided to publish in the Review and Herald her articles in the Health Reformer. They did so. She had one part in it being served at that time, but they chose to do it and just published the series right
because
down the line.
Way, so
we mustn't take too much weight on the fact that it may be found in the Review and Herald. It's just an automatic reprint of what has been done before.
Can I speak back to that?
Okay.
The Wasp Waste article appears in the Review of October 31, 1871, on page 112.
Dr. Kobe.
I have a series of short questions.
Yes, sir.
Did you happen accidentally on this Health Reformer item, or did you ask another question?
No, I read this one in the Health Reformer. I read it first in the Review of 1871. About 15, 18 years ago. It was when the reprint, the Review and Herald reprint came out, and I was reading through, and that's where I found it. And so in that book at home, I have a little notation, you see, in the front, page so-and-so, the Wasp Waste. So for about 15 or 20 years, I have been just troubled about it and didn't know what to think about it, but I'm sort of coming to this conclusion.
So we are not facing a problem, but we are inquiring. I think it is good because we are only reacting. Yeah.
Well, it did come up when Ron Numbers wrote his book.
Oh, yes, and I had some correspondence
for years, yeah.
Decades before that.
Now,
not often, but just. Now, we would like to also have the editorial deadline to pick up on the right of Paul, and she rushed through. Do we find any similarities in this? She had an assignment, and she had to meet the deadline.
You know, this is something that every man has to decide for himself. I could say, well, now, that one's inspired, the other one isn't. That doesn't compel you to believe like I do.
No, in terms of the experience, we have done the same. She has to provide so many things to her and here she has to provide a book. And her book was on a giving or something, the rest could have been something else. However, I just like to see what argument anybody else could have against the
explanation
that we are providing.
That's just one criteria, that's not all of them.
I look on sketches from the life of Paul in a different way from these articles. I do.
And I have an answer to you. On page 7 of your paper, you quote, you will write the same other copy, I am not the one. From the last connected to that paragraph. Now, they seem to be being a reality literary assistant. First of all, when do they start working for her?
Now, if you don't, forgive me, get into that. If you don't mind, I'll leave that up to Ron. He'll cover that before the day is over, I hope.
Any more? Okay, yes, thank you.
I've got two questions.
absolutely.
I'd have to go check it. Elder White, are you aware of the settings?
I don't have it in my mind at the moment.
No.
It can be checked, but I don't have it.
I'd have to check it, Ed. I don't recall.
What?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. This is in connection with David Paulson, because the next two pages, pages 38 and 39, have to do with the number of rooms in the Paradise Valley Sanitarium. And the Ballinger is the one who has said that he wasn't going to believe Mrs. White anymore because he got this wrong. And David Paulson came into this too. So here is where she made this statement in that connection. I think that's correct.
The other person I noticed was the reformers here in the back office. I was wondering if Ellen White had to say about their
Bible. The only things that I have ever been able to find, Ed, a couple of statements, early writings, and her comments are to the effect that, but she doesn't cover the whole waterfront. And I don't have her statements with me, but it's early writings is where these are. She says, some will look to us gravely and will say, don't you suppose there are errors in the copyist or the translator? And she says, this may well be. So she is not talking about the autographs, yes or no. She only deals with this question that some have raised. So I don't think she addresses herself to the question of the autographs. But she does allow that there could be errors in the manuscript, as we have. In fact, the other reference is where she specifically says that some people deliberately change the words at a certain point, thinking they were improving the meaning when they weren't. So we have those two statements from her, aren't we?
Well, that's also in 1 SM 15 to 22.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Warren?
I feel what we're doing here is comparable to skirting along the edge of a rainbow, trying to determine where the rainbow ends and the sky begins. I find from my own study of literary borrowing that there's a lot of intermingling here, and it's hard to really define where the, where the starting point is, where the starting point is for non-borrowing. And I would just need a couple of highlights on what I found regarding. I didn't know this to be the topic today. Ellen White uses material, and I've looked at some of the sources, where she'll take some of the diagrams, like on the walkway, and she, if you go just a couple pages further in that same article, beautiful, striking picture of a walkway that's in the article. That's taken out of Gunn's Domestic Medicine, and I'm beginning to find part of the material in parallel to Gunn's Domestic Medicine. Similarity there with Larkin D. Coles, and the two brothers are also done, and done is prior to them. So we find that kind of mixture there. Also, I found that some of the statements to help the former articles were put in the testimony, maybe in a little different form, not precisely, but they're there. So we have to look at kind of the whole spectrum of really what's happening here when they talk about literary bonds.
Dalton Baldwin?
The question comes up again, that came up this morning. I'd like to make another point. There was a census of Ellen White in 1889 when Wagner and Uriah Smith were complaining about Ellen White changing their position on the law immigration. They asked her, did you receive a vision on this?
Sure.
Or is this just your opinion? Now, it was at that point that she reiterated her criticism of Butler for trying to make a distinction in the Bible between that which is inspired and that which is not inspired. And I was quite nervous this morning when it seemed to me that we were making the same mistake that she criticized in Butler on the Bible. We were doing that at Ellen White's room. I think it would be better to say, God inspired Ellen White, and we should have great confidence in what she writes. We should act on everything she says, unless the underlying harmony of what she says, the underlying harmony about the whole, the underlying harmony of what she herself says, is contrary to that. Or, unless acting on that idea will produce proof which is contrary to the criteria of the material, and not attempt to decide whether it's been inspired or not. That's a better way to go. And I think it is a very good idea to acknowledge that there are errors in the Bible, and in the 90s of Elvin Price, and that we can handle them in the way that she did in the next sentence after the one that she talked about in Mary Wright. She says, certain men thought they were going to improve the Bible. They put into it their erroneous position instead of improving it. But if we use those ideas that form this self-consistent chain, we don't need to panic, because there is a self-consistent chain of truth in the Bible on which we can depend without any problem with it. I think it's better to read all of the writings with great confidence, acting on every sentence, unless the underlying harmony of the whole corpus of material is contrary to that sentence, which in these cases I think it is, along with our work.
Dr. Gould?
I'd like to go back to your reference, rather indirectly, to the devotional book, This Day with God. I believe that's a direct title. The letters on the same day of the year, and so on. As I have read this devotional material, in the setting of my more recent analytical thinking about Ellen White and her role, as I've rubbed shoulders with you folks and the problems you're facing, and as we've seen things in the archives from her time where individuals were dealing with these questions too, you know, I followed along in my own private way thinking about them, puzzling and stretching out in this direction, and then pulling back, and you know. When I started to read some of these letters, I had an uneasy feeling. And I think it ties in with what we're saying here. I had the uneasy feeling that there were going to be other Adventists who hadn't been thinking about these things the way I've been thinking about them, who were going to be reading a letter to Edson or a letter to Brother and Sister Haskell or whoever, and we're going to be thinking about that in the same way they would think about something that's been published in a testimony or something that was in the Desire of Ages or Counsel from Back to Foods or whatever. Well, an earlier work perhaps. And over and over again, as I read from day to day through those pages, I had the same uneasy feeling. I didn't have a problem that what she wrote to those individuals was not inspired, or should not be taken by them as counsel. But I was concerned about the generality of that material, how someone else who looked upon that material as a direct counsel to them for that day in their lives, almost like a horoscope, if you please, were just not going to be looking at it the way they ought to. And putting that thought of weeks and months ago into the mix this afternoon, I'm thinking of the word audience. Now, Ellen White wrote a great deal of material, and we could lay it out on a spectrum by audience. Sometimes when she was writing, she knew she was writing to the church at large. She intended it for the church at large. She intended it for that day and for the years to come. It had one dimension of generality in terms of geography, another in terms of time. There were other times that she was writing for non-Adventist audiences, preparing her book for the world in general. There were times that she was writing letters that were directed at 5 or 6 or 10 leaders of the church only. There were times that she was writing to just one individual. I don't know where the health reformer material falls under the spectrum, but it occurs to me that perhaps the matter of audience and intent may contribute something to us in this discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Which page?
Page 18.
18.
This is the election ruler. And this quotation mark, put in there, or this is the way it was when it first came out. Or was it when it had to be published?
So this is the way, when they published this health reformer back in, what's the date of this?
1871.
Mrs. White stuff came to the typesetters and they set the type this way.
Yes, I rather think so. I think she liked it, and because she did, she put it in her column. But remember, we're saying we don't believe she was doing so as a prophet. She was doing so as the editor's wife trying to help him to keep the paper going.
Jim Nix.
Well, I just repeat what you thought, because I have a real problem with that, I think. As I recollect, that she later on was writing 4 columns a month for the Review, and at times she was writing a column a month for the Times, and I don't know what else she was writing for the Big American. I think whatever explanation we come up with, just to say that she was so rushed, not that you're too defensible in the field. And I think they're going to say the only reason you want to say it isn't inspired is because science doesn't support it. And we move right on to a question that I get asked quite fairly often out there, is, and I think we bring another topic, but it's kind of related, I think, and that is, why do you assign a certain writing to an apocryphal file when they seem to be contemporary and are we falling into the same thing? I think we need to look at what's going to be asked when you get out in the field. Are they going to, how can you extend this concept when she was writing more for other journals? You know, you see the other two stuff, and that's all inspired. Is it just because you don't like what's being said and it's not scientific?
Did I have a shot there?
It's not just that, but you know, when she says, if you write to Brother So-and-so up in Marshall, Michigan, you'll get good seed for your tulips or whatever, I mean, bulbs for your tulips or whatever it was he was selling. It's the nature of the material, too, that relates to. I mean, whether or not it's right or wrong is not the only criteria that would enter into this feeling that this is somehow in a somewhat different category. At least some of it is in a different category.
Well, that's what I would agree with. I'm wondering when we start spending this video, and they say we've been putting this for the last 100 years, and putting this book, and now all of a sudden you're wanting to take this block and move it out because it's in a department. I'm wondering how defensible that really is. If I have all the borrowing that Walter Ray spoke about, I can't read yet, but I understand you're pointing out which department's saying, and what people are saying that are reading it here.
I think that's good. I think the other way I want to respond on that point.
I wanted to respond on the point of the article in the Review of the Times that you spoke of. I have just been working on the manuscript for the Australian year on August 4th, August 6th. Ellen White took with her to Australia, Fanny Bolton. Worked on a newspaper, and she wanted to go to Australia, but it's just a surprise. Help her struggle for that. Fanny Bolton's work was to assist in the preparation of articles for the journals. Now you'll find when you read this book once or twice, Ellen White tells of how she wrote. Wrote compelled by the Spirit of God to write. And also wrote letters. All these materials were copied. Then one copy would go to Fanny Bolton, one copy would go to Mary Davis. Fanny Bolton, so she might use the materials in periodical articles in the Review of the Times. Now, some of the articles Ellen White would sit down and write straight through. Many of them she did not. They were compiled from sources that I've named. Marion Davis would go over the material carefully, searching for anything that dealt with the life of Christ, because she was working on the Tower of Eden. And when Elder White was writing to Elder Corliss, who was carrying on the debate on the Sabbath question in one of the Australian cities, there were messages of warning to him in which Elder White turned back to how the Pharisees Christ tried to lead Christ into discussions which would hinder the ministry. And she was counseling Corliss to be very, very careful. And David said, I was delighted with that. I found so much that I could use possibly in the manuscript of the life of Christ. Touching points we hadn't had material before. So I wouldn't put the fact that she was furnishing articles month by month, week by week, the review and the signs and the instruction in the same category as where she undertook to provide a department of so many pages for the health department. It's a whole study of the paradigm.
Okay, Jonathan? Well, a lot of what I've been thinking about is getting answered, but I think from an historical perspective here, the thing that interests me is how the community might have received this department and what clues we can get to that. If there's any way that James White might have introduced her in this column. I don't know that there is. That would be one thing that I think would be significant. Or the way she might have been used by the community around her at the time. We're mentioning that this material did make it into the review in some cases, or into testimonies, or into copyright. Did Kellogg pick up any of this? Or did, you know, with this being as some sort of source, it seems to me one of the things we have to think about here is here's a journal that's suffering in terms of circulation, and James wants to give it a shot in the arm. And Ellen is a fairly good source for that because of her credibility or her authority. Even if they don't think of this on the same level as other writers, I think among many of the Adventists, it's bound to have a sort of a special impact because Ellen is writing. Contemporaries are a lot more comfortable with this kind of thinking. Maybe there's sort of a natural, they're not holding Ellen White to a sort of everything is on the same kind of level that maybe came later. I don't know.
As to reader reaction, Jonathan, I can't answer the question. And I don't know if anybody else can.
Well, the list of the paper increased and came up and developed under this type of management.
Of course, a lot of those readers were not Adventists. They were just people who were interested in health reform. And it could be that James White saw that having a woman as a columnist in a health paper was a good idea.
Quite apart from her being a prophet. I don't know what the subscription list was when he took it over in 1871, but in 1874 it was up to 20,000. In the 25-day period early in 1874, there were 800 new subscriptions that came in. So people were liking what they found.
How many members did we have in 1874?
Sorry, about 4,500 maybe.
Hey, I've got you down. Okay, Elvis?
For some reason, I don't see any other members at all. You could find some inconsistencies in the writing. I don't think we have to say, I'm going to value her writing if I can prove her to be intelligent. I think in our philosophy, we have the answer to our dilemma. We have said that when she claims not to be intelligent, therefore, we should be able to define an illustration of her credibility. She always points to the scriptures as the final standard, and we don't say anything, she did not say any verbal illustration. Therefore, I don't know that we need to try to justify so much the fact that she didn't have, but then look at what kind of, what shall I say, consistency we find. Are these significant for salvation? They are in a Veruca area. But personally, I'm glad that God used an instrument which was human and fragile and fallible, which avoided so many of the mistakes all of us, any of us, could have operated if we had been in the storm. And so, personally, I think that we should be learning more when we find this kind of thing. Because Bible writers are made, for example, talking about Bible as personal. Because in the Bible we have inscription, we have the right description of intent. It says, if they were without poison, they would have been more than human.
She's talking there about their personal lives.
I was talking about their character, but I think she's getting older.
Okay, it's 4:43, almost 4:44, and we're going to continue this discussion. I want to save just enough time to at least give you this paper on Fanny Bolton and just give you a little introduction to it before we close tonight. We won't have time to discuss it. Then I'll put everything that I have to present into one presentation on the literary assistance and literary borrowing and everything tomorrow. We could start passing those out, yeah.
Yeah.
Just two small comments. I was interested in Elder Price's distinction. I'm sure it wasn't an artificial distinction, and it's saying there's a difference between a prophet and an editor. I sort of like that. I'm rather comfortable with the direction that this conversation is going. I think that what Dalton and Helmut have said expresses basically my own view. Because Mrs. White makes a very dangerous statement that it's not the words of the Bible that are inspired, but the people. Now, I apply this to Mrs. White also. She was an inspired person. Now, was she always under plenary inspiration, let's say? She herself denied that she was infallible. Consequently, I can allow quite a lot of latitude myself. I don't think that we can say that she was under such pressure anymore. As a human being, she was doing the best she could under these circumstances. And as we know, if the Lord even permitted the pioneers to make a mistake in regard to mathematics and so forth, and the Lord overruled it for a purpose, I think if we have the right attitude toward these things, we're not going to get uptight either. These things speak to us or they don't speak to us. I think probably what is kind of hanging over everybody here is this concept still of a kind of verbal inspiration and a kind of infallibility, which we keep denying, but in practice we keep working on.
Yeah, and then when we find a mistake, we feel defensive.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Veloso.
I have a question. Whenever we come up with a problem, something which is difficult to explain, which seems that you start to try to find some principles to explain away the problem. But my question is, does anybody ever make a good, complete study on the principle of hermeneutics that Jenny defines herself has through her writing to be applied to her writing?
Several of us in the Ohio State have studies that we present on hermeneutics that they apply to Ellen White's writing. Elder White has written on this. I have a study on it.
What I mean is what she said.
Yes, based on her statement.
Yes.
And Joe Battistone in Carolina is working on a book right now on the hermeneutical principles laid down by Mrs. White for the interpretation of Mrs. White in the Bible. But we don't have anything in proper form at the present time.
Probably that is our problem. Because we always tend to react to some difficulty we find. And we are not always consistent in the way we solve one problem and then another problem. If we would develop a sound, systematic group set of principles taken from the field of prophecy, probably we would be much better off in all the other
about the problem. If we're going to have that hermeneutic principle already clear, then we will be all the time struggling with this kind of problem.
Yeah. Elder White, I think, is planning to discuss this point of hermeneutics, aren't you?
Elder White, yes.
Yes. It's in the first section A. I don't know how much he's going to say on it, but we could stand a book. We could stand a book.
Okay, Mrs. Jemison?
As I think over the discussion, I'm thinking of all the questions that are coming in the room that have been suggested.
Could you speak louder?
I think we're going to have far less questions, if indeed as it is, than if we're going to try to make categories. We have this from public comment for a good many years, and very few questions, maybe one more year, but I can see all kinds of questions that are coming. And I think as scholars and students and people that really are going to be far less.
Betty, may I ask you a question, if you don't mind? Are you telling me that you believe that the articles in the Health Reformer in Mrs. White's department were written under inspiration in the same sense that her articles in the review were?
I think you said it. I think that she was always under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. I think her life was directed. Now, I think this is probably at a department, but it would probably be for economics, so this might be the outpouring of the community in this area. But if we're going to start categorizing this, rather, we're going to have lots of trouble.
Now, will you allow Ellen White to write common materials?
Well, surely I do.
But I don't mean just letters to the children. I mean something that's printed. What makes it inspired? Is it when it's printed? You know, excuse me, I don't mean to be impolite, but I'm just pressing the question.
But
thing that I think we would agree on at this point, having looked at it, is that this distinction between the sacred and the common doesn't simply have to be made in unpublished family letters. It does in the case of the Health Reformer articles, although we wouldn't classify the Health Reformer articles necessarily as uninspired. In the case of the Health Reformer articles, you do have to make a distinction between sacred and common, at least. Now, maybe if we made it on that basis, you'd still be dealing with the same criteria that you were before in answering questions. A last question by Trevor Delafield. Bob Olson, that he's so unthreatened by Are you?
By me.
And I talk too much, you know. And but he doesn't, you know. We work together in Australia, and we have such a good time.
Now, let me just present this thing about Fanny Bolton and point you to a few places in it that I think will be of interest to you. This document is historic. And I don't know just how it came to be. It didn't even dawn on me until I looked at the whole thing, that how historic it was. But this is one of the few times where, in answer to a question that's around the field and so on, we have actually published a very large, unexpurgated collection of source documents, rather than simply doing this. If you want to know anything about Fanny Bolton, except for one Kellogg letter which slipped through in the desperate effort to edit it at the last. If you look in the table of contents on the very last page table of contents, you will see that it lists the Kellogg letter, January 9, 1936, to Ballinger. That letter is not in here. It'll be in the next edition. I won't bother to explain how it fell out, but it's a problem involving computers and electronics, and not.
Do you have this page number that we could take that and put it in here when it comes out, or can you make extra copies available?
Actually, I could. Since it's on page 120, and we only have the last two sheets, I could redo. I could easily redo the last sheets, and we would have that in here. The significance of the Kellogg letter is simply that it's being circulated by people, and it's in this letter that he says that when Mrs. White learned about Fanny Bolton's charges, she got so angry that she slapped Fanny Bolton in the face. Well, when you read the whole collection and all the ways in which Ellen White dealt with Fanny Bolton, we don't need to put a footnote in saying Ellen White didn't do it. It's just absolutely ludicrous to believe that Ellen White would have slapped Fanny Bolton in the face. Even if you believe that Ellen White was a mean, mean person and likely to do this, it'd be ludicrous to believe, because you have all of Fanny Bolton's charges in here, and Fanny Bolton herself never made that charge. It doesn't even crop up until 1936, when John Harvey Kellogg, searching his somewhat defective memory, comes up with this idea. It was a very colorful idea, but absolutely ludicrous. It'll be in the next edition, and maybe, in fact, it might possibly be that I could get those two pages to you before the close of the conference. We've just absolutely prostrated the duplicating service of the General Conference, as you can well imagine, when they got 122 pages. Actually, this is about a 250-page document. But thanks to our word processor, we could put it in columns and single space it so that we could really cram it together. Now, Elder White will be dealing with this in his biography of Ellen White, and we will develop a paper on it as well, drawing on these sources. But here are all the sources that we dwell on. I just want to point you to a very few things. Turn to the first page. To begin with, Mary Chelsea White, in the first column there, always had a nice way of, humorous way of putting things. She says of Ellen White, "She has found another old maid that she wants to adopt into her family, Fanny Bolton." Now, Fanny was about 28, I think, at this time. And she says, and she is out working some mission. I think Chicago. She was who wrote the story in the Good Health that won the prize. And then down at the bottom of that column, Fanny Bolton is a treasure to me. We're on the first page here. Fanny Bolton is a treasure to me. We are all harmonious, all working unitedly and in love. Now, that was probably the last time that Ellen White was able to be so optimistic about Fanny Bolton, because here in 1888, and I want you to notice this letter 76, 1888, already Ellen White senses that Fanny Bolton has problems. "Especially do I feel concerned for Fanny. I want her to recover from this nervousness and wakefulness, and in order to do this, she must take time to rest the brain and the nerves, that she may not be completely out of tune like an old organ." Now let's skip over to page 2, the bottom of the second column. Fanny Bolton is writing on April 30, "Dear Sister White, I cannot help writing to you because God has helped me since I last saw you. I did feel so sad about being severed from your work when I had just become so reconciled." So even before she left America, Ellen White had Fanny Bolton working for her
Fanny had been separated from her work. But we won't have time to go into it. Fanny came back and begged and pleaded that she be allowed to go to Australia. Ellen White needed someone. Fanny had repented of whatever it was that caused the separation this first time, and Ellen White took her with her to Australia. Turn to page 5. Manuscript 34, 1892, in the first column. This is a diary entry. 1892, very soon after Mrs. White arrived in Australia. The second paragraph, I feel deeply grieved that all connected with me and my work are not in a favorable state of mind to be controlled by the Holy Spirit. I cannot keep in my employ some of those now connected with me unless the Lord converts them, leads them to see that their hearts must be brought into harmony with His will. Now, when Mayor Kellogg told the story later on, he says how he went to Fanny Bolton, told him about how these problems, and he went to Sister White, and he told Sister White. And Sister White said, did Fanny say that to you? And Kellogg said, yes. And Sister White said, well, Fanny will never work for me again. And that was it. And you get the impression from these stories that Mrs. White knew nothing about this, that it had never happened before, and all of a sudden, there's a little criticism from one of her literary assistants. Sister White slaps her in the face and dismisses her. And I want you to see how many years she labored with this young woman. Okay, turn over to the next page, page 6. Fanny Bolton, Ellen White, October of 1892. I received your letter today, and it was with a heavy heart that I undertake to reply. Please write the full as soon as you can, the whole dark picture that you may have to present, for it is time I knew myself, and so on and so forth. And here you have one of Fanny's confessions. And in this collection, you'll have again and again and again and again Fanny's confessions. And I'm sorry, folks, I have to do this to you, but this collection will destroy your appreciation for the hymn, Not I But Christ. Because this young woman just sang that hymn every other time, but she went right back into whatever it was she was doing. Now turn to page 8, first column. Fanny Bolton, Ellen White, in October 7. Now, about last month's mail, after I got through with Elder Uriah Smith's letter, it was a letter of stern reproof, this was after 1888, you see, I felt utterly exhausted and went to bed early, but woke at 1 with one of those dreadful headaches. Whenever Fanny had to copy a letter of reproof, she got a dreadful headache. And this would go on for 2 weeks. She would be ill with migraine for 2 weeks. She just could not handle that sort of thing. Let's skip along here to, we won't worry about anything. I've marked some of these. Page 18. Another confession, Fanny Bolton, Ellen White, in 1894. I have passed an almost sleepless night and would say this morning that the selfish and ambitious words I have spoken in regard to the work represented only a momentary attitude toward it, for the undercurrent of my mind is not in the channel of seeking glory for myself. And then look at the bottom of the page, Ellen White's response to this. She's going to get many of these letters. She says, I just received and read a letter from Fanny, and it has the right ring in it. And I'm so thankful that she is trying to surrender herself to God as she has never done before. I hope and pray that this trial may work our good, in the glory of God. After you shall consider, she's writing to her son, Willie, after you shall consider the whole matter and think it over and pray over it, let me know what is the impression of your mind in regard to my taking Fanny back. I want to do exactly as the Master would have me do. If the warnings given have called Fanny to repentance and she appears to be truly converted, then will it be best to trust her in this matter? Let me know what I should do. She's talking to Willie. I mean, this is the first big episode in Australia, down in Melbourne, where Fanny has criticized Ellen White, and she had been separated, but Fanny has confessed, and Ellen White is willing to take her back. Now, let's skip along for a while again. Let's see. Yes, on page 26, I think something very important, and this will help us tomorrow in getting an idea of Ellen White's concept of literary property and who should get the credit for writing things. The left column of page 26, this is a letter, it's a long, long letter, as you can see. It goes clear back to page 20 where it begins, I guess. Anyway, she says about it, she was in vision. An illustration was given me of a tree full of beautiful fruit.
I was shown Fanny gathering the fruit, some ripe, the best, some unripe. She put it in her apron and said, "This is mine. It is mine." I said, "Fanny, you are certainly claiming that which is not yours. The fruit belongs to that tree. Anyone may pluck and enjoy it, but it belongs to that tree." And if you think of the fruit as the truths that God has to communicate to people, I think you'll get the image. You see, it doesn't only apply to Fanny, but Ellen White's whole concept is the truth she might have found in another author's work. It's important to understand how Ellen White viewed truth and literary property. She says, "The power of discerning good and evil is an attribute from God, and unless the human agents are in vital connection with God, they cannot discern spiritual things. They will call good evil, and will call evil good." Okay, let's run along here. We're 5 minutes after. I suppose the truck is waiting for you, but page 37, Fanny Bolton to Miss Malcolm. She has talked to Miss Malcolm, and she has given her certain impressions, and now Fanny is trying to undo some of the criticism. She says, about four lines down, the right-hand column there, and Sister White is the prophet of the Lord for the remnant church. And though the Lord has seen fit to choose one for his work who is not proficient in grammar and rhetoric, and this lack is supplied by others, yet she is responsible for every thought, for every expression in her writings. Every manuscript that is edited goes back to her for examination. You see? Now, let's move on. I think it's the style, literary style. Page 40. Things are going along pretty well now, you see, with Fanny and Ellen White, but suddenly we have another element introduced, a brother Caldwell. This is a man who got the idea that the remnant church was Babylon. He had married a wife. Well, he had been a Sabbath keeper, and he wanted to get married. His wife didn't want to marry a Sabbath keeper, so he gave up the Sabbath so he could marry her. After he married her, he decided he had to keep the Sabbath after all. And she felt that she had been duped. And they had a bit of a falling out, and so he took off for Australia, left his wife and family and everything, and tried to convince Ellen White that the remnant church was Babylon, and instead of just slapping him down, she brought him into her family, gave him some work to do, let him copy some of her manuscripts. And he got his head straightened out theologically, but he had this other problem. "This morning, as I came from the school ground, I saw your horse fastened by the tree before the tent occupied by Fanny Bolton. After a while, I went to the tent. A lady from Newcastle and Jesse Israel were visiting Fanny. You were sitting down, writing on a typewriter. Why did you not take the typewriter at once into the dining tent? What impression can such a course make upon the mind of a young girl visiting at the school? It made an impression that was anything but favorable. Your freedom with young women is improper, and it is so natural and common for you that you think nothing of it." Now, he gives his counsel, and I'm sure they said, "Oh, there's nothing between Fanny and I." But very soon, a romance blossoms between Fanny and Brother Caldwell. Fanny begins to pray that if Brother Caldwell's wife will get a divorce, that's God's sign to her that she should marry Brother Caldwell. We can't go into that story, but sure enough, the sign came. Sister White didn't interpret it the same way that Fanny did. But immediately after this episode begins, Fanny starts criticizing Ellen White again. Now, that's something you won't learn in Evangelica or Walter Ray's book or anything like that. When you get these people into the life situation and you realize the whole situation, you can see that maybe emotionally some of the criticism wasn't just because of the objective problems in the writings of Ellen White. On page 44, second column, "My soul is bowed down in grief and agony as I see the course I have been pursuing. Truly I have walked in thick darkness and did not know it." And on, the most beautiful confession that you could want. And then page 49, the first column, Mrs. White in this document will sometimes exhibit a little bit of annoyance. And you'll have to get used to that. She says, "I've given nothing into Fanny's hands and never expect to give her another chance." Sorry about that typo. 39, first column, bottom of the first column. "And never expect to give her another chance
to seek to betray me and turn traitor. I've had enough of talent and ability to last a lifetime. Page 54, right column, letter 123A, I have been sorely tried for the past year with my workers. Fanny Bolton is disconnected with me entirely. This is on page 54, second column, right in the middle. Right in the middle of second column, 54. Fanny Bolton is disconnected with me entirely. I would no longer think of employing her. I would not think of employing her any longer. Now, notice that, because we're going to go over here to 64, and we're going to find that the Lord had other ideas. Elder White read to you a portion of the letter on page 65 yesterday. Here's another a diary entry. She says, as I was writing, I'm in manuscript 63 on page 64, second column, near the bottom of the page. As I was writing, a heavenly atmosphere pervaded the room. I have had the same experience many times in my life. I lost all sense of everything around me. I saw no symbol, no person, but a communication was made to me as if words were spoken. Fanny Bolton is not under the ministration of the Holy Spirit. Although she has proved herself unworthy to be connected with the work in which you are engaged, yet take her to your home and treat her as a poor, deceived child, as one who needs help. Well, this certainly puzzled Ellen White. It didn't seem to be the part of common sense at all, but she did take Fanny back, and if you'll skip over to page 71, you'll see that on letter 52B in the first column down there, just a very, very short letter, Fanny's health has failed, and she leaves us today for America. So that finally, when Fanny left, it wasn't at one of these episodes, I'm fired, I'm firing you, you go home. That episode had occurred, Ellen White had taken her back, finding her health failed. They didn't try any longer. They sent Fanny back, and Fanny writes some beautiful letters to Sister White on the boat, which you have there. We'll have to talk tomorrow about some of the statements about some of Fanny's accusations. Let me just quickly go to some of the things in the end of the document. Page 90. Right at the top of the left column on page 90, Elder Olson is writing to Ellen White. Fanny Bolton is creating something of a sensation here in the church at Battle Creek, and especially in the district in which she belongs. She claims to have received the Holy Ghost and is having a very wonderful experience and revelations from the Lord. By this time, Fanny's problems are getting more to the mental stage, and we're beginning to get some very bizarre kinds of behavior. You'll find her dancing an Irish jig here and doing little jokes and different things. Page 93, in the second column, I won't read it, but that's an important passage on the work of the literary assistants and the different work that Marion Davis did as opposed to Fanny Bolton. And then on page 104, you're in the midst of one of Fanny's confessions again. And I would say this, that at the bottom of page 104 is one of the best statements on the work of Ellen White's literary assistants that I know of. I don't believe it because Fanny Bolton wrote it, but it is well put. The editors in no wise change Sister White's expressions if it is grammatically correct and is the evident expression of an evident thought. Sister White is a human instrumentality, has a pronounced style of her own, which is preserved all through her books and articles, that stamps the matters with her individuality. Many times her manuscript does not need any editing, often but slight editing, and again a great deal of literary work. But articles or chapters, whatever's been done to it, is passed back into her hands by the editor instead.